knew Daylight was a hit. I knew it was a hit. Tommy Burns came. It was a songwriting session. We wrote all those songs together. I came in more with Why. It was a 4-song demo that we all collaborated on.
Okay.
Tommy had brought in Daylight. It was great, man. The chorus was, he had the whole chorus, all the melody and stuff like that. And he handed me these lyrics, and the lyrics were, I'm really big into the lyrics. It's very important to me. And I really refused most of the time. I had other words in my mind, like a dick. I won't sing shit that I don't want to sing. You know, especially like terrible lyrics. I was like, Tommy, I'm not singing that. So he wrote a lot of lyrics and turned it around. And the song I knew was a hit. Oddly enough, no one knows this story except my inner circle, but I had a dream before I was supposed to go in and sing the lead vocal for Daylight. I had a dream. And you know, when you're preparing for a song and you're singing the song and you're working on it, and lyrics change even in the studio when you're doing it, I had this whole spoken part, in the absence of the sun, the dreams I have each day are left in darkness. The ever nightfall, I'll be that light till the end of time. That spoken part kept playing in my mind, and I woke up and I was like, I wrote it all down.
All right, see, that's how you do it.
that's pro.
So this is Caffeinated New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
This is a podcast, essentially trying to find out where people get their creative spark from, and I'm here with a dear friend of mine from way back, Paul Mahas, who's with us today. How you doing, Paul?
I'm good, Dave. How are you doing? We go way back.
We do. But I think what'll be interesting today is maybe I can get some answers to some questions that maybe I've never asked you or I've never known about you through your life.
Right.
The thing that I'm kind of hoping to get out of this today is just kind of trying to find out where you get your creative juice from. Now, you've been not only a musician, but an actor and an entrepreneur, and I'm kind of interested to know where that came from in your life. So, for starters, I mean, like, give me like your elevator pitch of who is Paul Mahas.
Boy, that's a tough one. You know, I really say singer-songwriter, but for a long time, you know, I knew what I wanted to be when I was very young. Like, I remember in first grade having the epiphany of wanting to be a performer. Now, I didn't care if that was acting, because I loved all the TV shows. I loved Elvis, you know, singing and all that. So I realized that those people were all performers. You know, when a kid says, I want to be a fireman, I want to be a policeman, I want to be an astronaut, a lot of the times they're getting that information from TV shows or movies that they saw. So I came to that realization very early on. And really, honestly, I knew what I wanted to be from that point on. I've never, ever strayed from that.
What were some TV shows you watched when you were a kid?
Urgency. That was the fireman thing.
Right. Yeah, I remember that.
Dragnet, Columbo, all the old-timer shows. Because, you know, at the time that we were growing up, you had usually one family TV at those times, and everyone watched TV together. So whatever they were watching, and, you know, the Wonderful World of Disney was always on, and all those great shows like Old Yeller and, you know, the Kurt Russell things, and Absent-Minded Professor, whatever that one was, you know.
Now, you mentioned, like, a lot of dramas.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, Emergency was, you know, I mean, it always had a humorous element, usually at the end, but it always dealt with, like, real serious topics.
Yeah.
Dragnet dealt with serious topics. Did you find yourself kind of leaning into serious roles or serious acting or serious things, like, as you got older?
Well, you know, I wound up joining the plays in high school, and I always wanted to do that, the musical theater stuff. I had to wait for my older brother Pete to graduate, otherwise he would have kicked my ass, you know. Then I was, and sure enough, when I wound up being in the plays, he had graduated. You go, I hear you're in the plays, you know, what are you, thespian now?
Right.
You know, and, you know, I was like, I had to defend myself and say, you know, Yeah, that's what I'm doing. And if anybody has a problem with it, then, you know, I'll fight anybody to defend myself, you know.
How big was your family?
Well, you know, you were asking about the, you know, where that all came from. So I had a mixed family. I grew up with my aunt and uncle, who were really my mom and dad figures. They were mm-hmm. the disciplinaries. They were the mom and dad role. So my mom lived with us, but my mom was more to me like a sister. It took me a long time to really figure out what that family dynamic was. And, you know, if I said to you when I was a kid, aunt and uncle, I was really saying mom and dad, you know. If I, and again, my mom was, you know, I love my mom dearly, but we just had a very different, it wasn't a mom-son relationship to the extent that you would think that, you know.
And did your brothers, you had brothers, right?
Two older brothers, yeah.
And they all lived with you?
Yeah.
You all grew up together?
Yeah, in that house with my aunt and uncle. And it was just a very, very different dynamic, a great dynamic. But it definitely, all those things definitely play a part in forming who you are as a human being, as an artist, as a performer, but most of all as a human being, mm-hmm. you know.
Were they all theatrical?
My brother was, and that's, you know, without my brother Jerry, he was the older brother, and he was the guy into music and into the plays, but he was older than my other brother Pete. My brother Pete, the middle guy, is the one that wanted to kick everyone's ass. He was kind of like the typical quintessential middle brother. I learned a tremendous amount from my brothers, but I really owe my brother Jerry the performer, singer, songwriter aspect of my life, because I always looked up to him. He was really tremendously talented. He could pick up any instrument and just play it great, you know. Had a great ear, was always a great lyricist, you know. So it took me a long time. As a matter of fact, I didn't pick up the guitar until I was 19, and we were in a band together. I was just singing at that point. And I just remember the band always saying, "Oh, you don't know what the music's like because you're just a singer." And it just bothered me so much. At 19, I said, "I'm picking up that guitar," and I slept with that thing. I played that thing morning, noon, and night, and I taught myself guitar. I had great musicians that I played with that you would always show me stuff. Here's an E chord. Here's how you do the A, and you know. So I learned from really, really great people, but I learned very late. And yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I like I said, I kind of owe all that to my brother, Jerry.
And your other brother is Pete, right?
Yeah.
And
Pete's crazy.
Pete's crazy. So that's the crazy one. So you got, like, you know, maybe that part of your personality, you know, a little bit of crazy from Pete and a little bit of
Well, definitely music. I think that was handed down from my father, and my father was a great guy.
What'd your father do?
My father was an off-the-boat Greek, like Zorba the Greek, came, you know, very broken English. My dad left when I was about 3, so my brothers remember my dad. I have no real memory of my dad. And when my aunt and uncle took us in, it's because my dad left, and my mom was having a hard time. And so they took us boys in, but my brothers thought going to my aunt and uncle's was going to be the best thing. And my Uncle Joe was a retired cop, and he was very, he was a very unique character too. Very, you know, told you like it was, you know, and very, very straight, you know. You could say, you know, that generation too, and that generation was very bigoted, you know, prejudiced, you mm-hmm. know. Not in a mean way, but just that's how they grew up, you know. Although that sounds very, you know, in today's day and age, you know, all those sensibilities are, you know, you can't really speak about those things. But that's real. That's how we grew up, you know. It didn't make sense to our generation in that regard because we were involved in such a culturally mixed schools and stuff like that, you know. And you were friends with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
especially, I mean, in the theater, you know, being artistic in theater, you know, you generally find yourself in a bigger melting pot than if you're in, you know, if you're just into sports or you're right. into, you yeah. know, I don't know, yeah, no, math club or whatever, yeah. you know, there's a wide range of people in the theater kind of
yeah.
world
yeah,
that,
yeah.
that you kind of get to mix with and get to yeah. learn about them.
Yeah. You know, I think our generation kind of was where I think a lot of those things, you know, I feel went away for the most part, you know. I think now it's kind of rearing its head in other ways that I never really thought would ever happen in modern society. It's very strange to me to watch some of what's going on right now. Mm. You know, that those are the lenses of culture and stuff that we look through. And all those things, the time that we're born really impacts who you are. To your point, like growing up in the era that we did, you know, really we're like a product of the 80s because that's when we were going, you know, junior high and high school. And so that had a huge impact on me, on the music, because my music has elements of hip hop and elements of rock and punk and, you know, classical. You know, Elvis was a, you know, huge, huge influence for me personally, you know.
Performers, you know.
Performers,
like,
right.
Like not just the, you know, like there were musicians who were very theatrical, mm-hmm. and then there were musicians.
Bowie.
Yeah. Then there were musicians who were just musicians. Yeah. Nobody would ever, you know, disparage Steely Dan, right? The band, for what they produced, but not one person, I think, would stand up and say that was a great live band to go
right.
see because they
yeah,
really
yeah.
put on a show.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You went and saw a performance that sounded like the record.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But Bowie and Elvis and, you know, a lot of these other, you know, performers, U2, Bono, you know, they all added a little bit more to a show.
Yeah.
When you went to see them,
right.
you got, you know, you were getting what you paid for.
Yeah. Yeah, I was a huge U2 fan. And not in the beginning, actually, when I was in the band with my brother Jerry in that time that I was telling you about when I picked up the guitar and we had a band called Friday Night in London. And it was because we were such big fans of the English music that was coming over. LIR was a big radio station for us. And they were playing The Police. They were playing U2, the early U2 stuff. And I remember my brother was really into them. The Smiths, The Cure, New Order, Depeche Mode. We were really, really into all that stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. And that was the music we were playing when it came out. Crazy to think of that now. You know?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
It's classic now.
Yeah.
But we really love that stuff. You know, I was a little bit more mainstream because I was, the time was like Billy Idol for me and George Michael was a big, you know, vocal influence. You know, I loved all that stuff. And then my cousin, who I grew up, you know, I grew up with my aunt and uncle, my two cousins who were, you know, really like sisters to me. So when I say cousins, I mean sisters because we lived together. And me and my cousin Grace Hamm were very close in age. So she was a Durani. And I remember like wanting to hate it. And she's playing it in a room. And every day you would hear the same songs. And I'm like, wow, this is really great stuff, you know. And I was really blown away. Like, I thought Duran Duran was a great band. And I thought that they never got there. I think they're respected now. But I thought that they were getting really passed off as, you know, flash in the pan boy band, but they're a really great band, great musicians, great songwriting, very, you know, so all that stuff came to me from so many different directions, you know. I got the Elvis from my brother Jerry, and also the Beatles, Elton John, Billy Joel, all that stuff was really, really big, and those were the records that my older brothers were buying. My brother Pete was more into like Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath. And at that time, that stuff was really too heavy for me. I didn't like it. It didn't resonate with me. You know, I was listening to more lighter stuff. I loved the Elton John stuff. That stuff was like very and the Beatles, of course.
Right.
You know, so for me, my musical lineage is like Elvis, the Beatles, and everything else after, whether it's Queen, Bowie, Elton John, Billy Joel. You know, those kind of fall under Elvis, Beatles, you know, for me personally.
These influences that you had were a strong frontman.
Yeah.
But there was always somebody alongside of them that was helping develop that music, whether it was
Steve Stevens. Yeah.
You know, he was Billy Idol's right hand.
I love his playing.
You could say anything that Billy Idol did without Steve Stevens didn't sound quite like Billy Idol.
Right.
So as you developed as a musician over the years, did you find that you that part of your development as a musician was to bring on good side people? Were there people that you worked with that were
I always felt like when I found what I thought was the right person, I don't think they, you know, I always kind of felt they didn't really embrace it the same way like I was their Billy Idol to their Steve Stevens, you know, let's say. You know, I had a lot of great players growing up, you know. But I had my friend Rob Math, who I just played with recently in L.A. We would write a lot of songs together, and he was so good, man. And we wound up doing a lot of recordings, a lot of writings together. And we went out to L.A., and he just fell in love. So he wound up moving to L.A., and I had planned to move to L.A. at the same time with him. And for some reason, I don't know if I got cold feet or whatever, he left and I stayed. And no regrets, because I wound up getting signed after that. And, you know, life just takes you where it takes you. And that is part of the process, too, you know. Life is, I think your life is your ultimate creation, you know. Like, you're still developing, you know. Like, I was born to play this part, you know. This is the role I was born to play,
right,
you know.
Right. So you said you were playing with your brother.
Yeah.
You were playing in a band with him.
Yeah.
And then, where did that go? Like did that turn into something, or did you guys?
So that was a really cool original band. Crazy, crazy time. We had this, manager, Wayne Jordan, and we rehearsed in his basement. You know, we thought we were like the cat's meow. We thought we were going places, you know. And it was really cool. I mean, you know, we really developed our craft. It was a really good band. We played at all kinds of great places. We played at the famous My Father's Place at the time. You know, Sundance, all these great Long Island places. But we just missed. I played at CBGB's, you know, what were those other famous places? The Lion's Den and Bitter End and... you know, all those cool places.
So were you getting booked at those places?
Yeah, like, we were getting booked. But we just missed the heyday.
Okay.
By like a couple of years.
Got it.
So they were like now running on fumes, and we play in there, and the places were, you know, kind of not packed, and you know, we wound up developing a really good following. But I was going to college during that time, and I got cast in a musical. You know, I went to college for theater. I went to Suffolk Community for theater. Great. I did Shakespeare. I did all kinds of really cool dramatic plays while I had my band Friday Night in London. And I wound up getting cast in Elvis Musical Celebration, which was backed by the Elvis Estate. You know, and I just learned to play. That was right around that time. I was 19 or 20 years old. I just learned, of course, the first things I learned were Elvis songs. So I heard on the radio, if you're an Elvis fan and you know, come audition for this Elvis musical, I'm like, I gotta go, you know. So I auditioned, and wildly, I got cast in that show. And it was huge. It was like such a big production. Imagine it was the producers of Beatlemania, which was huge, and the Elvis Estate. You know, so I met everybody involved in Elvis's career. So when I was, you know, I got cast completely unexpected. I didn't think that was going to happen. And now I had to decide, do I want to go on the road or leave the band? And everyone's like, you got to go. You're crazy if you don't go. And I'm glad that I did go, because it was I met everybody. As an Elvis fan, you can't get a better experience. I met everybody in Elvis's life, in his career, We played at the Las Vegas Hilton that Elvis had a residency at. So we played on the stage that Elvis played on. You know, all over the country, all the major theaters, a lot of places where Elvis, you know, performed. But particularly in Vegas was crazy because it was his original marquee. And it was his, you know, it was his stage that we played at. And at that time, Colonel Tom Parker was still alive, so I met Colonel Tom Parker, Priscilla, Lisa Marie, the George, some of the Jordanaires, some of the band members, DJ Fontana. You know, I met who were the other guys? Carl Perkins, Jerry Lee Lewis, all came to the show. Sam Phillips, who owned Sun Studios. So it was a really, really cool experience. And like I said, and then we played in Memphis. We got a private tour of Graceland and stuff. So as an Elvis fan, you weren't getting any closer
right.
to his life. And yeah, it was really, really a great experience. And I had a great role. I was the only cast member besides Elvis that had a solo song. I didn't, by the way, I wasn't cast as Elvis. I was cast as like a character dancer. So I did a lot of dancing in that show.
Okay.
I had a monologue and I had a solo song. So it was the only
what
character.
Song?
Mama Don't Allow. It was like this old, like, so it was kind of representing, I was representing the youth that Elvis was supposedly corrupting, you know?
Okay.
So it was kind of like a rebellious song. Mama don't allow no guitar playing around here. Mama don't allow no guitar playing around here. Well, I don't care what the mama don't allow, I'm going to play that guitar. Mama don't allow no guitar play around here, you know. So it was a really cool song, and I did it like a knee slide, and it was like crazy, you know. That's why my knees are in such terrible shape. I did those knee slides,
okay.
You know, like twice a day in some cases when you did the matinees and the performances. Vegas, it's always two performances, you know.
So this show goes on for how long? How long? Are you
2 years.
On tour with it?
So 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah,
so
2 years on tour.
You're 20?
21, 22.
So were you still, presumably you got, if you were in college or you were
I never finished college.
Never finished college.
No.
Okay, so you get off.
I left.
Right.
So I got the job.
You got the job. Yeah. You won. You won.
I even said to my teachers, should I go? And they're like, go.
Yeah, go.
You know, what's a degree in theater going to do for you?
Right. All right. So now you get done with that show and you must feel like
great.
You feel great?
I felt great because I thought, you know, that was so easy
right.
getting the parts. And then, you know, I wound up doing that audition thing in the city. And I went on so many auditions and got no's and rejected. And, you know, when you get a part like that, you're always now like the rock and roll guy.
Okay.
You know, so I was getting calls for rock and roll stuff, you know, no legitimate theater, even though I knew musical theater from high school and then college, you know. I always studied musical theater, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was always, you know, I had a love for that. And I thought that was where my career might take me, but it didn't. And then I did some acting things, just pure acting. And I landed like an episode of America's Most Wanted.
Right.
And I played a villain.
Seen.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I
broke into somebody's house or something.
Yeah, yeah. It was. I played a real criminal, and that was weird. You know, like Alan Golder was the character's name that I played, but he was a real guy, a real jewel thief on Long Island, and that was cool. I did some of those really cool things. So it's like once you did, and then I kept auditioning, and then I auditioned for Yoko Ono. And I got that part. And that was crazy, too, because I was auditioning so much. So I landed a role.
Was it an open call?
It was an open call.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you go...
I was going on all kinds of open calls.
You're in New York.
Yeah.
This is on Broadway or off-Broadway?
That was off-Broadway. Okay. But I was going on every call. So Warner Brothers had a show that they were doing. It was for Six Flags. Six Flags, Milwaukee. And so I auditioned for that. I kept getting the callbacks. I got that gig. I was going to be... It was my show. Like, I was the lead in this show. It was
what
like...
was the show?
It was like just a rock show. Okay. So I would be singing whatever, like all these great rock tunes.
With a backing band.
With a backing band. Okay. It was big, and I got the part. At the same time, I auditioned for Yoko, and it was such a crazy thing because you get called back. You're like, oh, I'm getting the callbacks, okay. Maybe I have a chance, you know. Mm-hmm. And after so many rejections, you're like, So I go back, and now we're in one of Yoko Ono's lofts in you know, downtown Manhattan. And I remember they had us in a circle, and all these people are there, you know, all potential cast members. And, you know, the first one with a creative idea jumps in the middle of the circle and does something, dance move, something. So I'm like, you know, I'm never the first guy to go in those things. I hate auditioning, mm-hmm. you know. That's something anybody should know about me is I hate auditioning because they're not performances. I'm a ham mm-hmm. by nature. You know, mm-hmm. if you're not there to be entertained, it's very hard for me to, you know, turn it on in that.
Right.
You know, it just was always very uncomfortable for me, so I hated auditioning. So I was like, you know, in the circle, you know. And this kid who looked like me, he was the guy that I knew that I was up against for that part. So he runs across the room and does a drop kick into her wall through the sheetrock and kicks a hole in a flying kick, you know, and kicks a hole in her wall. And everyone's like, you know, and I was like, fuck,
yeah,
he's going to get the part. And he did. He got cast.
Okay.
So all that's going on. I get the part in the other show. I get a call and they're like, hi, this is the Yoko Ono New York Rock. One of the performers got hurt and we'd like you to come in and do the show.
He broke his foot kicking.
His Achilles snapped.
Yeah.
So I'm like, what are the chances of having two great shows at once that you are going to get? And I wasn't a lead in the Yoko Ono show. So I was like, you know, and a Beatles fan. I just did the Elvis thing a few years prior. I'm such a big Beatles fan. Chance to work with Yoko Ono and be that close to the Beatles or do a Milwaukee Six Flags show. I chose the Yoko thing and I had to turn down. They were so mad.
You hadn't signed a contract.
I hadn't signed a contract, but congratulations, you got the part, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. You know, I was a day away from signing that contract, mm-hmm. you know. And I made that very, very hard decision to take the Yoko thing. And I played, the other guy was still in it. He's still a good friend of mine, Walter Winston O'Neill, who was the guy that drop kicked the ceiling. And we're really good friends to this day. And he's a very, very talented guy. And a very, very good friend. And, we always laugh about that. So he was violence one. I was violence two. And in the script, it was kind of like a semi-autobiographical picture of Yoko and John, where they did like the character. It wasn't Yoko and John, but symbolically it was, you know. So the lead guy, the love interest, gets killed, and I was the guy that did that symbolic killing. So every night in the wings, I would have to wait with the gun and, you know, have to do the symbolic killing. It was such a tough thing to do, man. Mm. You know, but, you know, you get yourself into that thing. And I was, you know, I played that part. And, you know, when you do those parts, you really, you know, I take the acting very seriously. Even when I did the, you know, when I did the Bono tribute, and I played Bono in a U2 tribute band, you know, I played Bono. I did. Mm. I took that on as like a character, as an acting thing. Mm. You know, when I was up there, I was Bono.
Right.
You know,
right.
I didn't think of myself as Paul Mahas, you know.
Yeah.
So that's what you do when you take those jobs on. So I was going out there to kill that guy that night, and it was, and again, you know, in your mind you're like, oh my god, I got to do this. And then when you hit the stage, that's your job, and you're in that mental thing, and you know you're gonna portray all that, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. anger and I was my character was violence, you know.
Right.
So
right.
you had to portray violence,
right.
you know, which is very not me. I'm so peace, love, and understanding, you know.
Right. So how long does the Yoko show go for?
That only ran for like a couple of weeks. It was at the WPA Theater, an off-Broadway thing. But I got to tell you, man, I'm so glad that I did it. Yoko was amazing, which a lot of people think, you know, oh, what was it like working with Yoko? She's crazy. She was one of the nicest people, so humble and endearing, one of the nicest people you could ever meet. She was so good to the cast. She had us all up to dinner at the Dakota. So I got to have dinner and talk with Yoko in John Lennon's apartment where he wrote Imagine. And, you know, I got to plunk his white piano that he wrote Imagine on. And it was wild. It was, you know, again, as a Beatles fan, to be that close, one degree of not even one degree of separation, you know, it's...
Give me a sensory kind of... all senses firing off? You're in that
surreal.
Is it a normal apartment? Is it bigger than you expected? Is it smaller than you expected?
Way bigger than I expected.
High
ceilings.
There's a lot of people. You know, I don't know that I have ever seen any photos. Of the inside of that place.
She had. So I was on that first floor. There were living spaces. Floors. Yeah, it was huge. The ceilings were very, very high. There were lofts in there. Mm-hmm. Where they would have like cabinets, you know, like big cabinets on the walls, you know. And supposedly what John would do is he would crawl up into those cabinets and close them off and be in there with like a tape recorder. Like, so, you know, what do they call it? Sensory deprivation, you know.
Sensory deprivation chamber.
Yeah. And I think that that's where they got some of his recordings, where the Beatles then did the newer recordings.
Free as a Bird.
Free as a Bird, all that stuff came from him on a little tape recorder. And that was going on while I was doing the show. Mm-hmm. So that was really cool because we were hearing about that before it was ever announced that they were doing this Beatles thing.
So she asked you over for dinner. Did she make dinner? Did she get takeout?
That's such a good question. No, she didn't make dinner. I mean, the whole cast was there.
Big kitchen?
The place was like, it was a whole floor.
Yeah.
She had two whole floors of the Dakota. And
what did you guys eat?
I don't even remember.
Wine? Did they have, you know,
I probably drank some wine. Okay. Of course, you know.
Did you stare out of the window and kind of see
taking everything in
Central Park?
I did all of the above, and then I remember sitting down and Yoko, you know, had a, just like you and I are talking, me and Yoko are talking, and I remember her saying, like, telling me, she was telling stories about like how John wrote the Ballad of John and Yoko,
right.
and then he jumped out of the car and he started writing, and it was just like. I'm getting the chills thinking about it because it dawned on me at that moment, really like crazy stuff. For us, this is a guy who's mythical.
Yeah.
Right? She lost her lover, her best friend.
Right.
And it struck me at that moment that for her, it was so personal and deep, you know, that I didn't have. Of course, we were all upset when those icons of ours die. Mm. Yeah, we feel a loss, but it's not a personal loss like that. Mm. And that moment really, really struck me as like, wow, this is so deep and intimate for her. And she was sharing that with me and other cast members too. But
how many people were in the
Well, there was probably, 20 people, 20 or less, maybe even less than that, 15, 12 people in the cast. I don't quite remember exactly. But it was a really good show. It was her music. It was all based on her music, and she wrote great music, you know? It was really, really, it was good music.
So it's a couple weeks, and it ends. Were you expecting it to end?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it was a limited run. Right. I think that everyone hopes that it'll get picked up, you know, by someone. It didn't wind up getting picked up, and then I was at that point I was doing Come Off the Road. I was then at that point writing and recording my own originals, my own stuff. Mm-hmm. And I had a solo project called 8 Million Stories. And that's, at the time, my brother, when I left Friday Night in London, Friday Night in London turned into New Life Crisis while I was on the Elvis tour. So,
okay, so you're not in the band. Your brother continues on, and he changed the name of the band because maybe you're not involved anymore?
Because my brother Pete had a dream and said, I got the best band name for you, New Life Crisis.
Okay.
And you know, arguably it was a great band name, you know? Mm-hmm. I still have the name to this day, and my brother Pete gets the credit for that.
So New Life Crisis now is happening. You get off, you get out of this show,
mm-hmm.
and do you immediately reconnect with your brother and say, hey, can I join the band again? Can I get back in the band? Or are you like, I'm going to do my own thing?
They had already started taking off on the Long Island scene, and they were doing great. So it really, there wasn't
Here
really...
Was
to be 90s,
and they're primarily focused in Long Island, so they're in the Hamptons, or they're
like, no, like the Dublin Pub. They started doing stuff in New Jersey. They had hooked up with Stars agency and started playing Jenks and Tradewinds and all those places. That was way before me. They had already established those places before I even came into the band. So I was doing 8 Million Stories. I was playing in the city. I was doing, you know, an original thing. And it was going okay. It was going good. You know, making money. I was out there playing solo, by myself, which I didn't really enjoy. And then an opportunity came. My brother was kind of getting sick of the band, thing, and he wanted to step down. He's like, do you want to take over the band? And he was not getting along with the guys in the band.
Okay, so he left you with that mess.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because my brother Jerry is I think we're tough guys where we're very, I don't want to say critical, that's not the right thing. Not perfectionists either. We're just, you know, it's like you want it the way you want it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you demand, you almost want everyone to put the same passion that you do into everything that you're doing. And you find that a lot of people don't. You know, they don't take ownership. You know, when I bring somebody on board, I want them to take ownership. To me, there's no greater gift than saying to somebody, hey man, I brought it here. Take this on with me. Mm-hmm. Let's do this together, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times people don't, you know. Maybe they're in it just for the paycheck. Well, who knows what everyone's motives are.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought everyone had the same motive that I did, and I was like, yeah, we're going to make it.
Right.
You know?
Right, but that wasn't the case with them.
No.
They were just like, eh,
no.
You know,
yeah.
Something to do on the side.
Yeah. And when I came in, I said, listen, guys, I'm doing an original thing, and I don't want to stop doing originals. We had always been an original band. Even Friday Night in London, we were writing and recording original music.
Mm-hmm.
So we were an original band that played covers. Whatever covers we did were kind of like our own. And so I adopted that, and it always stuck with me, even to this day. So, you know, yeah, I'll do straight covers for sure, you know, and of course, when you're working, you do weddings and cover gigs where they kind of expect that. But I was very lucky, and I think we were very lucky that even our covers that we did, unique people wound up loving our versions of it. So we always got away with that. So I always considered ourselves an original band that did covers.
Got it.
You know?
Got it.
And even that was like kind of like a rub for some people. Some people just wanted to be in a cover band and they didn't want to be creative, which, never made sense to me.
Right, right. So you're doing New Life Crisis, and something happens at some point where you get the interest of a label.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
How does that happen?
So, New Life Crisis is doing great. My brother kind of really handed me a very successful band, you know. So I immediately was in all these places, Jenks, Tradewinds. Some people didn't like me right away.
Why?
Well, because they loved my brother.
Okay.
And I was the guy, you know, I was changing the lead singer.
I'm his
brother. He wanted me to do this, you know. But some people just didn't like it, and I was more of a performer. You know, I danced and I wore crazy outfits and stuff like that, you know. Jerry was more like a musician's musician, you know. A great, you know, he was a great performer as well, great singer, great musician. You know, like he played bass and guitar for the band, you know. I did play acoustic guitar for the band, but I was a showman. I took that very seriously, and some people wound up loving it. And I think we built on the success that my brother had kind of built to that point. And I think the band would have been wildly successful with him as well. And he was writing and recording too at that same time. So I kind of continued that. When I joined the band, I said, the only way that I'm going to do this is if you guys want to do originals. And they all said yes. But truthfully, no one rehearsed. No one wanted to write with you. It wasn't a band in that regard. Mm. So I wound up, you know, going out to L.A. and I paid for everything for myself at that point. And worked with producers and all these other people. And there was a lot of other stuff going on at the time because of all the stuff that I was doing. I had auditioned for a band, Full Force, that produced Lisa and the Cult Jam, Samantha Fox. And they took me under their wing. And they were trying to develop something with me. So there was a ton of irons in the fire. And I was kind of now working in real, you know, high-end situations. You know, those guys were working with Britney Spears at the time, NSYNC and all that, when I came on board, you know. And they were recording me at that same time. I remember me and Britney Spears standing on their stoop knocking on the door. Oh, you're the girl that they were telling me about, you know. And, you know, who knew that she was going to blow up to be Britney Spears, you know.
Right.
And so anyway, so at that time I was doing all that stuff, and I started working with a famous Long Island guitar player, Tommy Burns, and him and I started writing together. He brought in another writing partner that he was working with, Tony Bruno, and Frank, my old manager, came in and he invested 20 grand, I think it was 20 grand, for us to go in and record a 4-song demo for Enrique Iglesias. And Enrique hated all the stuff.
So it was for him to go and record. So
yeah.
Like, here's four songs by a writing group.
Well, Tommy and Tony worked with Enrique. Okay. They were both his musical director, because essentially Enrique would hire Billy Joel's band to tour with him when Billy Joel wasn't touring. So when Tommy went back with Billy, he gave the role of music director to Tony Bruno. So Tony Bruno was Enrique's music director. Oh, he had Enrique, here's right. songs that we wrote for you, for your record. He hated everything. What is this, George Michael's?
What were the songs?
It was Why. Mm-hmm. You remember that song?
Yeah.
I Need You. Mm-hmm. Through Eyes. And Daylight. And and we recorded them all at Tony's place in the city. And at that point, because I was doing New Life Crisis, and they were working, they had other artists that they were working with. Again, it was such a crazy time. There was so much stuff going on. So we recorded the demo. I got turned down by everybody. It went out to everybody. I got turned down by everybody. And you get the rejection letters, you know, thanks, but no thanks.
Right.
You suck.
Really?
Give up.
No, stop.
You know.
Is that really?
It's, you know, they're so brutal.
That's what you read into.
Yeah.
Like,
well, we went, interested. One meeting that I went on with Tommy and Tony, where no one took the thing on. We had a meeting with some big, like, booking agent. And you go to the office and you're sitting at a table and you're waiting. They keep you waiting for like an hour. Mm-hmm. You know, you're sitting there forever. You know, they just keep you waiting on purpose. So you're sitting there all like. So the guy comes in. He's like, who's the artist? I'm like, me. He's like, too old.
Oh, wow.
It's like the meeting was over, you know.
Yeah.
So they're like, and they knew Tommy and Tony. So he's like, all right, let me hear what you got, you know, like begrudgingly. You know? Mm. Ah, this is crap. You know, you ever hear you listen to the Backstreet Boys. They're going on tour. So it was just no, rejection. Mm. And it was brutal, man. And, but, you know, Truthfully, I had the spirit. I knew Daylight was a hit. I knew it was a hit. Mm-hmm. Tommy Burns came. It was a songwriting session. We wrote all those songs together. You know, I came in more with Why. That was my song. I don't remember who wrote I Need You, but it was a 4-song demo that we all collaborated on.
Okay.
So Tommy had brought in Daylight, and it was great, man. The chorus was great. He had the whole chorus, all the melody and stuff like that. And he handed me these lyrics, and the lyrics were, you know. And so I rewrote a lot of lyrics. I'm really big into the lyrics. It's very important to me. And I really refused most of the time. I'm a kind of judge in that way. I had other words in my mind, like a dick, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I won't sing shit that I don't want to sing.
Right.
You know, especially, like, terrible lyrics. I was like, Tommy, I'm not singing that, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I rewrote a lot of lyrics and turned it around. So, and the song I knew was a hit. Oddly enough, no one knows this story except my inner circle. But I had a dream before I was supposed to go in and sing the lead vocal for Daylight. I had a dream. And, you know, when you're preparing for a song and you're singing the song and you're working on it, and lyrics change even in the studio when you're doing it, I had this whole spoken part, in the absence of the sun, the dreams I have each day are left in darkness. And should the ever night fall, I will be that light till the end of time. That spoken part kept playing in my mind. And I woke up and I was like, I wrote it all down and I go to the studio. And it's at Tony's apartment in the city, like a little dive apartment in the city. A nice apartment, I shouldn't say dive, but you know, this is a Manhattan apartment. So I did the vocals. The vocal booth was his bathroom, you know, and those are the vocals that were on the record, you know, to this day, that got released and Tommy Boy bought. Were all recorded at his apartment. So I kept saying to the guys, I gotta put this part in. I gotta put this part in. And they're like, all right, but you gotta sing the lead vocal. All right, but I gotta put this part in. Okay. And so I do the lead vocal, and they're like, okay, now I got to put the part in. You got to do all the harmonies. You got to sing all the background vocals. Okay. So I do all the background vocals. I'll put your stupid part in. So I put my stupid part in. But to me, to have a dream about a song and just know that that was divinely gifted, you know, that's my connection to, you know, God and Jesus and spiritual. You know, I don't share that, but to me that's always an element of things that I put into my music, the themes of light and dark coming out of the dark. I think I told you that long before when we were doing some of the great artwork that you've done for us, and you always incorporated those themes. I always love that. But so I knew, like, I just had such a strong inner guide and feeling about that song, and it was a number one hit, you know. And that came about. It was such a really bad time, great time, terrible time, because they had got it to another artist who was a Long Island girl. She was Victoria Fajella. She was a background singer for Enrique. And they got her a deal with Sony Germany. And they said, hey, would you mind if Victoria sang Daylight? Well, why would I mind? Right. She's got a deal with Sony Germany.
Right.
Get to have a songwriting credit on a record, you know? So, you know, they did this song with her. It sounded great. I loved her version of it. And the song came and went. It kind of got released in Germany. Didn't go anywhere. At that time, my record now started blowing up on LIR, my version. And now all the record companies that had just turned me down were now all calling. We love this song. We love it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, that, what a lesson that was, and like what idiots people are and what little imagination they have.
Yeah.
You know, they can tell a hit when it's on the radio, you know?
Right.
You know, they can't hear it. They couldn't name a hit to save their life or call a hit to save their life, you know? And it was like, they saw that we were getting spins. And the best advertisement that we had, it was like, and we won the 9 o'clock knockout, and that's, I don't want to bore you with that story, but it was like, it was a progression to get us getting regular rotation on a radio station. And you would see where, like, Vertical Horizon was out at the time, Smash Mouth, you know, Sarah McLachlan, whoever the, you know, those were like big bands at the time. 65 Spins a Week, Atlantic Records. Next to mine, it said unsigned. So that was like the best advertisement.
Yeah,
how is this unsigned band? We're paying millions of dollars.
Yeah.
How are they getting 65 spins?
Yeah.
So this song must be good. And that's how that started. And I had a great lawyer, Ron Beanstock, who was really such a good guy. He was a great lawyer. He still is a great lawyer. And he said, listen, you're getting all these deals, all these proposals. He had said, I like Tommy Boy because they're an independent record company that's backed by a major. And I think that that's a really good place to be because you'll get the independent attention, but you'll have the money of a major. So Eddie O'Loughlin was my A&R guy, and Tom Silverman was the president of the label, and they both signed us. That was a big deal, you know, getting signed by the president of the label.
Mm-hmm.
And Eddie O'Loughlin is a famous A&R guy. He had his own record company, Next Plateau Records, which he signed Salt and Pepper. He found them, you know, and what a nice guy. He was a great A&R guy.
Mm.
But right after I got signed, right when we were trying to get the record together and record a record, the label, I get a call like, this won't be family friendly, but like, what the fuck?
Right,
you know?
Right.
Kind of call. The song blew up in Germany. Who the fuck did, you know? And I don't know. It becomes like an overnight smash, number one hit, fastest selling song in German history type of thing, you know?
Oh,
and they didn't know how this happened. And there was so much going on at that time, you know, with Tommy and Tony, and there was a lot of friction because of things that went down that were just whatever, just not cool, you know. And so we weren't talking, and it was like Eddie O'Loughlin was trying to get us back together, and right, which we did, we got together. He brought in Kenny Laguna, who's Joan Jett's manager, to have a sit down with Tommy and Tony, because both Tommy and Tony played with Joan Jett.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew Kenny, and they brought him in to kind of
mediate,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we started working together until the song became a hit, and now it was just crazy. And everybody then ran back to their sides, ran back to their corners. And now the fight was really on. And it was hard because, you know, we were friends, you know, and like really good friends. So there was that anxiety of like, oh, and they're your writing partners, and it's a number one song.
Yeah.
So if you can imagine, I did not enjoy any part of that being a hit.
Yeah.
It was so stressful because you were in fight mode, mm. you know, and it's just like, what, you know, everyone's yelling at everybody.
Right.
So big lawsuits and da-da-da. It turns out that the publisher that they had kind of negotiated with in Germany for Victoria Faella, the publisher, loved the song too. And when it bombed with Victoria, or didn't go anywhere, I shouldn't say it bombed, it just didn't do anything. He got it to this show called Pop Stars, and it was the breakout single for this band that they had formed on a TV show.
Mm.
So like American Idol, the breakout song.
Right.
And so that's why it was such a big hit. And Daylight was chosen as their breakout single, you know? And it was huge. It was, like, so big. And it was great. That part of it was great to be, you know, associated with it. But it was very unenjoyable. And it looked, there were times where it was like you weren't going to get any credit at all, you know?
Yeah.
Because everyone now is fighting over songwriting and fighting over publishing and fighting over this and that. And you're in legal disputes with, you know, your family, your friends, your right. you know, your comrades. And it was very, very unenjoyable.
Yeah.
You know, time passes and things happen. It's now 20 some odd years later. I think this is 22 years or 21 years, the anniversary of it being a hit. I think that was 2001. And don't forget, you know, 9/11, all that happened while I was in, you know, getting, I was signed and, mm-hmm. you know, an artist living in the city, you know, mm-hmm. and just, it wasn't a good time, mm. you know, mm. and very unenjoyable with everything going on. But enjoyable, you know, like, oh my God, I'm part of a number one hit, you know, mm. And I knew it. I knew it was a hit. Yay, I'm vindicated. So it was very, very bittersweet. You know, there's a lot to be, there's so much to be thankful for. I have zero regrets or zero ill will towards anybody because, you know, it's still great work that you did.
Right.
You know, people's egos and idiocy gets in the way. Mm. And that happens a lot with musicians. You know, they're just idiots, mm. myself included. Mm. I include myself in that.
Sure. Well, creative people in general, you know, can be...
Yeah.
I mean... The essence of what makes somebody creative is they have a personal vision that they're sometimes even reckless with,
right?
But their vision is their vision, and they're gonna see it through. And
yeah,
you know, people that taste success, you know, and people that don't taste success,
yeah,
both have followed that same path.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So this whole, you don't get the opportunity to taste any of the success of that as the success is occurring.
Yeah, no, it was impossible. You could say mistakes were made. Like, I don't know why we never went to Germany. I had German press calling me in the middle of the night. Did the girl steal the song from you? And I'm like, I feel this one, you know?
Yeah.
So I called the label and I said, this is a great opportunity for us to tell the story, and they didn't do anything about that. You know, being signed wasn't the end-all be-all either. I said, prior to getting signed, Lara Spencer had done a thing on wedding bands because she was getting married and she was going out and scouting wedding bands. And she's one of the wedding bands I was in, she was doing an interview with, and she was like kind of putting the wedding bands down. Oh, did you ever think you'd, you know, sign on to be a wedding band? And I said, well, honestly, all of us are artists and we're doing our own stuff. 2 weeks later, I wound up getting signed, or like a month later. So I told the label, I go, you know, I think Lara might be interested in this story. They'll never go for it. So I call Lara Spencer's, you know, production manager and say, hey, you know, she just did an interview and I just got signed. And they're like, great. And they interviewed me, you know. And if I didn't do that, if I didn't take the bull by the horns, they would have never happened. And I was like, why do I have a label? You know,
yeah.
it was just such a, you know, you learn so much when you're in these situations. You're signed. Like, I cried when I got signed because, you know, as you've been an artist your whole life too. Mm. You know, so I'm sure. As you know, and you have great art, and you're one of my favorites, by the way. You've done such a great job from the Life Crisis.
Thanks.
But you know, when you know, you're in those situations, you think, "Oh, I'm going to hit that plateau, and it's going to be great, and they're going to do. I'm going to have a label." It was almost like they didn't have the same drive and passion. It was like you were dragging them to their success. Mm. You know, and I felt like that a lot in my life. Like, I'm dragging to people why wouldn't you? I just did an interview with her. Oh, they'll never go. So I picked up the phone. I'm like that, man. I'm like, you know, I won't take no for an answer. You know, I pick up the phone. I call them. Boom, she's doing an interview. How cool, you know. Yeah, yeah. I got, you know, Best Buy with Bill Thiel. You know, those are all self-made things. You know, Bill got us, Bill Thiel and Donna Thiel, they got us some really cool stuff because Bill was with Monster, Cables. Mm-hmm. You know, so we did things on our own that were outside of the label. The label's like, this is great.
Yeah, right.
How'd you do that? You know, just by being creative and having the drive to do it. So, you know, success is really self-driven. It's not, you know, you think you're going to get to these places and they're going to know better than you. And to my experience, they don't. Even the thing that I was telling you with Daylight and getting turned down by everybody, you know, I'm giving you a hit song. Mm. You don't know it's a hit. Mm. I do. Mm. Because I'm the student of pop culture and music, and you know, I'm the artist, you know, and you know, it's like there's a craft there, and it's like, you know, and there's the gut feeling, and it's like you know it's a hit, you know. Listen, there's other songs that I wrote too that I think, given the right channel, the right you know, mainstream kind of drive, they're viable hits, you know. I totally believe that. And some of the things are paid for. I'm at a point in my life that I don't care about saying that. There's a pay to play. It's been around forever. Mm-hmm. I do believe cream rises to the top, but mm-hmm. all that exists. And right. you know, very, very profoundly in you know, it's just the gatekeepers change, you know. But the rules of the game don't really change. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I think, you know, that's a part of life that I think if I was to mentor kids, I would absolutely tell them these things and say, these are things to look out for. These are the scams. These are the roadblocks. And here's what you should look out for. But still have a kind of like self-awareness and a self-drive, mm. you know. Knowing that what you're doing, you're putting quality into it. It's you really, you know. There's songs that I've put out, even, you know, I painstakingly go through stuff. Like, you know, I won't put stuff out, and it'll sit for years and years. And I'm like, ah. And then I listen to it back a couple. I'm like, why didn't I was so hard on that song, you know? Why didn't I let out? So I'm doing that a little bit more now. But then it's like, you know, you can listen back to something and you say, oh, that vocal, it's a little flat there, you know, or that drum beat's out of time, you know, and you get really cooped out about the details, you know. I don't know if that, I'm sure that happens to you because I know the way you are with your eye and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. it does, there's also, I think, a point where, like, before I did this, I was never happy with what I did. And I knew I wasn't ever going to get. I wasn't ever going to create something where I was fully.
Yeah.
You know, I was okay with it.
Like, yeah.
So.
Right. That's weird. Isn't that weird? A weird thing to kind of get used to.
Yeah. And with this, I said, if I'm going to be my client, I'm not going to be my worst client. I'm going to just put things out and understand that not everything I put out is going to be great.
Right.
But. It's okay,
yeah.
Because there's a belief that there's something else next,
yeah.
And that's what that's why I keep going and doing something else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like you put something out. It's like, yeah, that didn't work. I can do something else next.
Yeah,
I'll do something that works next.
Yeah.
And if that doesn't work, it's okay because I have something else in my mm. pocket, and I'm going to try that.
Yeah,
and maybe that'll work.
Yeah,
and you know, I so far I've been fortunate that I've been able to make some good decisions.
Yeah,
you know, running, you know, two companies so far. And,
yeah,
and doing well.
Yeah,
or at least surviving. And making a living. And
yeah.
you know, it helped buy me a house.
Listen, I think what you've done is incredible, and you know, I always, you know, I always tell you, you know, the debt of gratitude that, you know, I have and the guys in the band should have. But and they do, but I'm saying for our relationship personally, you've always been like a trusted consigliere. So even when I send you stuff, because I know you're such a big music fan, you know, when I get the Dave Fletcher seal of approval, like, it's, you know, I'm like, okay, good, you know.
Right.
And so you're one of my trusted ears in that regard. Mm-hmm. And then you've always done such an amazing job with bringing the visual, like, you made our stuff visually elevated and intelligent, you know. Because I think that's the type of artist you are. I mean, you've got that intellect, you know, in all your work that you do.
Yeah, and I think to that, like, when I'm doing something for somebody else.
Yeah.
I'm looking for, you know, I'm never trying to do something that just satisfies myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to make sure that it satisfies the client.
Yeah,
the person I'm working with.
Yeah.
Me, I'm a different type of person because I'll never be satisfied with what I'm doing. So I had to make a deal with myself that anything that I do for myself or this company that I'm going to be okay with.
Yeah.
I'm going to be okay if I don't love what I'm doing, because I know that every day I'm going to have to do something else.
Yeah.
I have to keep it rolling.
It's a tough thing too, you know, because even it reminds me a lot of even the live performances where you have to give yourself kind of like flexibility. You have to give yourself, I don't know, take it easy on yourself.
Sure.
Where you know things are going to suck and you know things, you're going to have bad performances. You know, it's like letting things go. I'm very, very in my head when I perform, as you know, like, you know, It's a really, really weird place to be. But I do that even with the songs, and you just overanalyze it. So, to your point, I think you have to you have to know when to let it go and be able to release it. And, you know, there's projects that I have sitting now that are really kind of almost there, but there's a reason that I'm not, like, you're like, just, you know, I did this Best Damn Last Song and I did a video for it. I think now with the advent of AI that I might be able to kind of get the vision out that I want. Mm-hmm. I haven't explored the AI yet, and it kind of frightens me a little bit, because I think, I don't know, I've always been like technology real. The area that we grew up, we're analog digital, so we're balanced in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
We grew up with those types of artists. You know, Elvis didn't have auto tune, and you know, we were talking about Sinatra prior to the podcast, those types of artists, incredible, by the way.
Coming from an analog place, it gives you an advantage right now with understanding that digital is just, you know, it's the right hand. If the left hand is analog, the right hand is digital.
Interesting.
And if you can, you're trying to balance the two things. There are people who have grown up right now knowing nothing other than digital music. You know?
Right.
And they don't have
the
tangible.
Yeah.
But it's a shame to us, but it's not a shame to them.
Because they don't know anything.
Because they don't know it.
Yeah.
They don't know that. They don't know how to be precious about that stuff.
Yeah, but don't you find though, like some of the kids? I know your son is loving music.
Yeah.
He's going back to old stuff, man. He's got to be loving, like, you know, hearing the air pushed through the amp, you know.
Yeah.
And then they like rediscover vinyl, you know, like some ancient relic.
Yeah, well, I think there's an appeal to the vintage.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's an appeal to how it was. But, like, for me, there isn't an appeal to the vintage. It's just, I recognize the vintage for what it is.
Right.
I like picking up a record, and I love smelling what a record smells.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love looking through it because it's big.
Yeah. Yeah,
but I also remember going and buying those things, not like seeking them out, like a lot of kids do now. So, Well, I think that with that...
to be continued. So, there's so much more.
Well, no, I think we could do a whole thing with AI. I do think that, you know, have I discovered where you get your creative spark from? Yeah, I think so.
I mean,
look, you've come from a very difficult sort of situation that your life puts you in, you discovered that you enjoyed working with people and being creative while you were doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So got burned enough that you know you're finding your enjoyment is in the moment.
Yeah,
and your creative spark kind of comes from the moment that you're in at that time.
Yeah, I will say, and this could be a good place to kind of finish, but when I was young and I was going through some of those times, I had always prayed a lot and really deeply, like, please, Lord, let me make people happy with music, with singing. And that was a prayer that I had from when I was a little kid, when I knew that this is stuff that I wanted to do. Mm. Not so much with performing, but it was all of the above, you know. Mm. Lord, let me make people happy with music. And when I get down on myself and say, you know, you didn't make it, because that goes through you a lot too. I have made it, and I have made people happy, and I'm really, really blessed. And to some extent, my prayers have been answered. So that's, for me, the creativity part has always been there. It's just, you know, but probably born out of everything that we discussed.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you going down that road with me.
Well, I appreciate you being on this spectacular podcast.
I love it. Listen, you're one of my dearest friends, and I love you.
Yeah. Well, the feeling is mutual.
Yeah.
So
thank you.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
All right.